Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Amina Shakura coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show...
One of the things that we know that renters are fearful of is that if they ask for repairs or other things that are well within their rights, that they might end up with being evicted for no reason.
New rental reforms start today for Victorians, promising to deliver stronger protection.
Instead of having to rush and call and beg to see your paediatrician or psychiatrist, you can actually see your normal GP, same as you would for any other medication, and they can write that prescription for you.
New South Wales families to save thousands as GPs gain new ADHD prescribing powers. And later today...
Over 70% of them actually saw them as indicating danger zone. So it is kind of opposite to what we're supposed to indicate.
New study finds majority of South Korean students misinterpret beach safety in Australia. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Major rental reform comes into effect in Victoria today, marking significant boost to the rights and protection of nearly 2 million renters. Tenants Victoria says the change will help prevent unfair evictions and curb exploitative practices in a tight rental market. The new law aims to give renters great security, stability, and confidence in their housing. I spoke with Tenant Victoria Director of Policy, Advocacy and Engagement, Damien Patterson, about what each of these reforms mean for renters.
The ban on no-fault evictions is going to be really positive for Victorian renters. One of the things that we know that renters are fearful of is that if they ask for repairs or other things that are well within their rights, that they might end up with being evicted for no reason. This change will mean that renters can go ahead and ask for the repairs that they're already paying for so that they can live in a home that's suitable.
What impact will the ban on rental bidding make on the market?
The ban on rental bidding should make a bit of a difference, in particular in this really tight rental market. We see sometimes that renters are offering higher rents to secure a property. That makes sense when you're from the situation of an individual renter who wants to be able to find a new home. But of course, what it means for everybody else who's attending that inspection is that the property is going for more than it's advertised for, and possibly that they're spending a lot of time visiting properties that are open for inspection that they can't even afford what it's ultimately going to go for. So this should make a real difference and create some real fairness for all those people who are looking for a property right now.
Another one of the changes is a change in the notice period from 60 days to 90 days for rent increases or evictions. How will this help people in the rental market at the moment?
Having 90 days notice for a rent increase, and particularly for a lot of different evictions, will really help with people so that they've got time to plan their next step. It means that they can take a look at their budget, and if need be, it gives them the chance to find alternative accommodation. So it's just really a really helpful step for renters who have just received some bad news and now need to figure out what to do with it.
Well, I guess that extra 30 days makes a difference.
Yeah, particularly in a really tight rental market, it can take a while to find a new home. And of course, there's the processing that you have to do when you receive the bad news that your home's now going to be more than you can afford or that you have to leave it. There's a little bit of time there that it takes for somebody just to understand what's happening for them, what their options are, and what they'd like to do next. And then, of course, there's all of the steps that you have to take to get a new home. So 90 days feels like a more accurate reflection of what a renter goes through when they have these bad experiences. Really lets them put themselves back in the driver's seat and go ahead with some more confidence to make the decisions that are going to suit them and their household.
What do the new rules on advance rent payments and smoke alarm checks mean for renters?
The smoke alarm checks is a really positive step. So we want to make sure, I think we all assume that the property that we're renting is safe. We need to make sure that that's true. We have unfortunately seen some deaths due to faulty smoke alarms in the past, and so these changes are really in response to those deaths and making sure that when renters think that they're safe in their home, they really are.
Well, I guess today is a big win for renters in Victoria, but what further changes need to be made to make renting affordable, or specifically in Victoria?
Particularly, this change banning no-fault evictions is really great and gives renters some more security in their home that they won't be arbitrarily evicted. That said, the current system for challenging a rent increase that is excessive is pretty tricky, and it doesn't always work the way that it should. What that means is there's still an opportunity for a renter to face an unfair rent increase that may ultimately keep them out of their home. At Tenants Victoria, we're calling for a rent increase fairness formula so that a renter can be assured that any rent increase that they do, that they are subjected to, is something that's fair, something that's reasonable, and isn't going to immediately kick them out of their home.
That was Tenants Victoria Director of Policy, Advocacy and Engagement, Damien Patterson, speaking with The Wire. New South Wales government reforms are being introduced to allow GPs management and diagnosis of ADHD. Patients are expected to save between $500 to $1,400 each year, with even greater savings for families with multiple members living with ADHD. With more than 560 GPs already trained as continuation prescribers, thousands of patients have quickly benefited from easier access to prescription and ongoing care. I spoke with Dr. Rebecca Hoffman, GP and Chair of RACGP, who says these changes will make ADHD treatment more accessible.
Yeah, so what we're seeing for our patients is two things. Is for those that already have diagnoses and are already on their usual stable medication, they no longer need to wait or travel to see a pediatrician or a psychiatrist. They can see their usual GP to get their usual medication. So what that means is that, as with ADHD, sometimes things are forgotten or misplaced. So if you have forgotten your medication, if you're unable to source it because of the shortages we have with long-acting medication, or if you've just put it somewhere and can't quite remember, instead of having to rush and call and beg to see your pediatrician or psychiatrist, you can actually see your normal GP, same as you would for any other medication, and they can write that prescription for you. But as important is for the patients that I saw yesterday, that are looking at a new diagnosis. And so for them, that means that already there's no longer a 12-month wait to see a psychiatrist, because I can tell them that they can expect to be seen this side of Christmas. So it really has shortened the timeframes to get in for new diagnoses by ensuring that GPs can do the continuation prescribing instead.
Why is it important for doctors to be trained in diagnosing and prescribing for ADHD medication?
Yeah, so the key is around access. At a conference I was recently at, they said that 80% of ADHD can be managed in primary care, in general practice, and 20% of it really needs to remain the role of a non-GP. And that's where we would like to see it sit eventually, is we'd like to really see ADHD is the same as so many other chronic diseases that we manage as GPs, is that we can do the vast majority of it. We can manage our patients who are stable. We can manage the diagnosis and the initiation of patients who don't have multiple other complex diagnoses as well. But for those that do, for those that might have a few other things going on, might also have autism or additional complex care or additional complex needs, then we need to make sure that that 20% are able to access our non-GP psychiatrists and paediatricians as quickly as possible, that they're not waiting 12 to 18 months to get their initial script and diagnosis. Because that 12 to 18 months is a year and a half of school. It's learning to read. It's being involved in workplace, and it's absolutely life-changing when we can reduce those time frames.
And how will these reforms strengthen the role of the GP in supporting patients with ADHD?
Yeah, so I really see this as reducing stigma around ADHD. I really see that ADHD now is no more of a concerning diagnosis than any other mental health diagnosis that we prescribe. No different to things like diabetes, epilepsy, migraines. If it's a chronic medical condition, it's something that's able to be managed by a GP. As with all of those chronic medical conditions, if there's something that's different, if a patient's not responding in the way we expect them to, if they're getting side effects from the medication, we absolutely need to be able to access our support and our non-GP specialists to help us. Mm. But for the majority of patients, it will be life-changing. It'll mean they can see their usual GP in their same suburb. They won't have to travel from remote regional areas into cities. They won't have to wait months and potentially years for diagnosis and medication. It really is a positive reform.
You mentioned it'll be life-changing for patients. What improvements have you seen with families so far since GPs were allowed to continue ADHD prescriptions?
Yeah, so my patient I was talking to this morning who came to the press release, she was saying when they last did the Premier's reading challenge, she wasn't able to read. She was in year three and getting through just one book was a challenge. But this year, so less than 2 years later, she's been medicated and she's already finished her 100 books. She's absolutely flown through it. She's not only learned to read, but she now loves it. She embraces it. This is what's life-changing about prescribing someone with ADHD medication. It's not a fix-all. It's not a one-stop shop, but it means that she can then engage in OT and in therapy and engage in school and learn to read and actually see that as something that's enjoyable.
That was Dr. Rebecca Hoffman, GP and Chair of RACGP, speaking to The Wire. You're listening to The Wire on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amini Shakur in Melbourne. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CC 102.1 FM. And to our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3. And to the other side of the country to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. This year, Cape York Partnership celebrates its 20th anniversary of its Leaders Program, which has been a major success in closing the gap for disadvantaged remote Indigenous students. Though the program provides employment opportunities and scholarship for Indigenous kids, Cape York Partnership is urging policymakers to scale up support. Currently, the program only offers limited placement for students, with many talented individuals forced to miss out. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan spoke with Cape York Partnership CEO Fiona Jose to reflect on the program.
What we're really about is building capabilities of very disadvantaged First Nations individuals and families who've been left behind, really, in the economy. Our systems in our country have failed them. No work, passive welfare, addictions, and addictions have eroded personal responsibility. So we've been about how do we enable and empower our people through taking responsibility, providing structural supported opportunities and building their capabilities.
Now, Cape York Partnerships is celebrating its 20th anniversary, so congratulations. What are some of the achievements you've reached so far?
Cape York Partnership, actually, we've realised this year is celebrating 30 years, but our Cape York Leaders Program, which has had significant impact, is celebrating 20 years. And so our Cape York Leaders Program, we've actually offered over 600 scholarships for our young people in Cape York. We have 200 plus graduates, that's year 12 graduates, with an education outcome. We've actually had 94% year 12 attainment with 85% retention. So those that come into our program through to the whole end of year 12 have 85% chance of being successful in receiving a year 12 outcome, which is significant for kids in very remote and remote parts of our country.
And speaking of that, as you mentioned, the program has helped students in year 12 to complete their high school. How are you achieving these high rates?
I think, first of all, it would be remiss of me not to say the families are the key. Our families on the ground, their parents, they do this for the love of their children, right? They know and they want their kids to have better access to education. Only 10% of our kids come to us actually at any age level in literacy and numeracy. So they're a long way from kind of that academic achievement, which is why that whole year 7 to year 12 timeframe is so important. And often they feel they actually don't belong. So we have 100%, and we have always for 20 years, Indigenous support team. So that is First Nations people that work with and support parents and families and the kids and work with our partner schools. So that intense mentoring, tutoring, term event, cultural gravity, knowing who they are, where they are, being really proud of their culture and walking in two worlds really to take up the best of what the country has to offer all kids in this two-way learning with our partner schools.
You mentioned something very, very important, that the family is heavily involved into this program to help the kids to thrive. Why is this so critical?
Our families have been wanting this for a long time, right? They know the education system's been failing the kids. It failed them. And actually, if our children stay in community, they have 1 in 100 chance of completing year 12. So our families know this. They also know they want more for their children. They've been taking responsibility. So we work closely with families who are doing the right thing, taking their kids to school, ensuring that they support them. And as part of our program, they're making co-payment to actually be part of this program and to attend some of the best quality boarding schools we have in Queensland.
Now, I understand Cape York Partnerships is pledging policymakers to scale this program up. What are you looking for it to make this happen?
Because year 12 is the most single important strategy for closing the gap. What we know and what we've lived and what we've experienced and what this program is evidence of is that when a young person finishes year 12, the odds lift. They're more likely to work, keep earning, and raise children who do the same. State education system has been failing our kids, and we know that year 12 is the powerhouse outcome. And really, it's the strategy for building a good life, one that will close the gap, not only on education, but employment, income, and health. And we have to not only celebrate the small amount the children we've been able to do that for with our program. That's not fair. Every child in this country deserves a quality education. And that's why we need to scale up the program so that we're not just taking a small few and having them be successful, but that all children who want to and their families who are taking responsibility are guaranteed a good quality education in this country.
Congratulations on the program and congratulations on the 30th anniversary of Cape York Partnerships. That would be all on my side. Is there anything else you would like to add?
I think the only thing that I would add is this isn't rocket science. It's really simple. And so we just need to garner all the energy in the right stage and say all Australian children deserve a quality education no matter where they live in this country.
That was Cape York Partnership CEO Fiona Jones speaking with the wise Eduardo Jordan. New research found out 6 out of 7 South Korean students misinterpret the beach safety signage. The research conducted by Monash University and Life Saving Victoria surveyed more than 150 South Korean university students, and only 14% of them understood the yellow and red safety flags correctly. Very vague terms in English and lack of understanding in beach safety are some of the reasons of this high misinterpretation. The wise Eduardo Jordan started asking drowning prevention researcher at Monash University, Dr. Masaki Shibata, to explain more about the research.
This study is actually the continuous study of my previous work on the signage perceptions among international visitors. So we found that a lot of international visitors misunderstood beach safety signs. So the last year we focused on Japanese students, and then this year we focused on South Korean students because they are considered as a really high risk migrants here for the drownings. But what's different from the previous study is that we also tested various various different signs denoting no swimming and also red colored signs and comparing to yellow signs.
What are some of the reasons 6 in 7 South Korean students misinterpret beach safety signs is so high?
So basically that only 14% of South Korean students that participated in this study understood red yellow flags as a safety zone. However, over 70% of them actually saw them as indicating danger zone. So it is kind of opposite to what we supposed to indicate. So that's one findings. And also we tested other signage terms such as shore dam, shore break, and also blue bottle, submerged object. Those signs are also quite, you know, widely used at even popular beaches such as Bondi Beach. But unfortunately, almost none really understood what they meant.
Now, what would be the first step to start reducing the lack of beach knowledge across this sector?
So this question is actually quite complicated. I've been actually talking about this quite a bit because I think South Life Saving Australia and Life Saving Victoria, they work really hard to basically, you know, deliver the safety message. But at the same time, this study shows there are lots of different culture and different cultural perspectives. And for example, this study shows a slightly difference between Japanese and Korean as well. So Japanese people, they understood the Japanese term of rip currents much more than Korean translation of rip current. So there are all cultural differences. I think very, very first step we have to do is to basically collaborate with those foreign consulate general. For example, I actually directly contacted to Japanese consulate general this year based on my study published last year. And then I collaborated and revised their safety message so we can actually deliver proper message to Japanese people, because Japanese consulate general, they are the one who actually meet Japanese people, taking care of Japanese visitors, right? And the reason I said this area is very complicated is that I've been also giving a lot of beach safety workshops to international students. I visited a couple of universities and including Monash University. But what I actually found that although we are giving or delivering the message, but if you're not interested, you're not going to listen. If you don't think that you are high risk, what's the point they actually listening to your safety message? That's why the delivery of the safety message is quite difficult. So we actually about to publish another work. We developed English exercise material, particularly for IELTS, because a lot of migrants are interested in IELTS rather than beach safety. A lot of migrants actually have to get a good score in IELTS than learning beach safety here. So that's why we actually incorporating the beach safety information into the IELTS practice material and then ask them to use it to study English. But we also tested how much they improve their beach safety knowledge. We need to think about the way we deliver the message to those who are not interested, who are not aware of the risk.
Now, what are the recommendations the report provided to improve the literacy of beach safety with South Korean students?
In terms of beach safety signs, yes, this study shows that South Koreans do not understand the signage terms. Although they have experience in studying English, they are, in fact, they're university students, so they're good, and they would have like probably 69 years of learning English. But at the same time, previous work shows that domestic students, or let's say Australians, do not understand some of the terms either. So like, for example, shore dump. A lot of Australian people didn't know what it is. So at the moment, so we were using the English language that the native speaker potentially don't understand. And then we would try to translate those language, and then it's not actually translating properly. For example, if you put the shore break into Google Translate, it comes out the shore relaxation in Korean. And if you put shore dump, that actually comes out to replace to put the rubbish on the shore in Chinese in Google Translate. And I think the first step we may have to do is to reconsider the English terms and basically to be a comprehensive but also to be translatable. So I think that might be the very first step we have to work on.
Dr. Masaki Shibata from Monash University speaking there with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. And unfortunately, that is the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Brisbane. with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, X, and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people of the Kulin Nations, the traditional custodians of the lands where this program is produced. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. I'm Amini Shakur coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.